Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Baseball season. We've all been waiting for it. And before that happened, there was a lot of drama. As many of you know, the MLB and its players had a 99-day lockout that has obviously settled, which is how we finally had opening day last week. But, you know, the MLB has been struggling, actually. It's been seeing continuing trends of record lows in attendance. TV viewership is down and fan interest over the past 10 years or more. And that trend could be reversed. But it seems that youth baseball is sort of in jeopardy. Baseball in general is kind of in jeopardy. And in fact, it's sort of outlined in a book that was written by Kevin Gallagher. It's called Teach Your Kid to Hit So They Don't Quit. And that became the genesis of this movement called Save the Game. And we're going to learn all about it this morning, starting with talking to Kevin Gallagher, again, who is the author of Teach Your Kid to Hit So They Don't Quit. Good morning, Kevin. Thank you so much for coming on this morning. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing just fine.
So tell us a synopsis of your book and what led you to want to write it.
Well, the book is called Teach Your Kid to Hit So They Don't Quit, and it's for the parents out there to teach the ordinary kid how to make contact with a baseball. Why? Because kids play baseball to hit the ball and run. They don't play it to stand out in right field for 3 hours. If kids don't hit the ball, they're going to quit. And that's a pretty basic concept. But if they quit, you lose a baseball fan at a very early age, and eventually Major League Baseball loses the customer. And so it led me to the movement that we're going to talk about today, which is about the fact that the game of baseball is slowly dying, in our opinion. And we want to address that through Save the Game. Save the Game is a national movement brought about by the fact that we think baseball could be irrelevant in 15 years. Now, you have a radio show, Melissa, and you talk about government officials and governors come on. And very important stuff you talk about. So some of your listeners might be saying, why are we talking about baseball? Because this is a really important topic. Baseball is part of American history for the past 125 years. It's part of our landscape. It's part of Americana. And we can't imagine a country of America without baseball. And we believe in 15 years, it's possible that the customer base or the fan base of Major League Baseball will not be large enough to support it. And the reason we feel that way is because the average age of a baseball fan is 57 years old, way older than most sports. And that means a lot of people are in their 60s and 70s. And in 15 years, they may not be with us. Who's going to support it? It's the youth of America today. Mm-hmm. And we're contending that the game itself has changed so much that the youth are not involved with it. It's not fast enough. There's not enough action. They're going elsewhere for their entertainment. And so in 15 years, the base of baseball, the business of baseball, is going to be in trouble.
I find that interesting, Kevin, because I don't disagree with what you're saying, but why do you think baseball has become stale, per se? And here's why I'm asking that, because it's not like the game has changed. It's not like we've introduced a lot of new sports. So it's competing with the same sports, basketball, football. I won't even throw hockey in there because it's amazing how many people don't like hockey, but I'm a sports fanatic, so whatever. And I'm curious why baseball has become stale, because it has followed football in the way that they do fantasy baseball. People have baseball drafts and things like that. You know, they made the Little League, something that now is on national television, the Little League championships and things like that. So I'm interested to know, in your professional opinion, why you think baseball has become stale, that the generations after really the baby boomers are just not as into it.
Baseball as a business, and the game has changed. Okay, and I'll get into that in a second. Baseball has not made the changes that the NFL has and the NBA has and other entertainment venues. The younger generation, Melissa, you know it, they've been brought up with different habits, different trends. They like things to happen quick, fast, TikTok. They're on all different platforms that happen quick, music, shifting screens. The NFL is tied into that. The NBA has embraced hip-hop. They've embraced the younger generation. The Major League Baseball has been stale and stagnant. It's a slow game. And what they've done with the game is they've changed the recipe of the game. Now, the recipe of baseball always has been hit the ball, run, field, throw, action, people moving around on the chessboard of the diamond. The ballet of baseball is when the ball is hit. They've changed the game to a power swing. Analytic people have convinced the owners that the power swing creates a more valuable hit because two walks and a swing, you get three runs. And they're right. But that's eroded the entertainment value of the game. Nothing's happening in between the home run.
I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying.
We have a tremendous amount of strikeouts, and we have a tremendous amount of balls and swings and misses, and there's nothing going on for kids to sink into. There's 4 minutes between balls put in play. So kids watch that and say, this is not interesting, and they're going elsewhere for their entertainment.
Yeah, that's interesting, Kevin. That's interesting. We're chatting this morning with Kevin Gallagher, who wrote a book called Teach Your Kid to Hit So They Don't Quit. And it was actually the genesis of Save the Game. It's a new movement. It's a national movement that we're going to talk about in just 1 second. But, Kevin, you know, we were talking, interestingly enough, about how other sports have kind of moved with the times, essentially. Football, basketball, even hockey, I will say, has become more popular as well. And they're sort of moving with the way the new generation is. Fast pace, social media, just a lot of different changes. And it's in what you're saying is baseball has kind of stayed stale, but also it has changed. You know, you were saying like the batting, for example, it's gotten slower. It's not, you know, the same kind of baseball that we grew up watching, even in the 90s. It's just not the same, like the Chuck Knoblauchs of the New York Yankees. Like those players don't exist. They either walk or strike out, and that's the end of it. And and that's kind of what baseball's become. What about golf? Now, why is golf so successful, do you think? Now, of course, I know you're focusing on baseball, but like golf, surprisingly, is very popular, and it's kind of boring to watch. It's incredibly boring to watch. I love golf, but I just find it's interesting that golf hasn't become too stale for the new generation.
Well, golf's a whole totally different sport. It's if you look at it in the realm of any other sport, from a media rights standpoint, which is what people pay the leagues to carry their sport, football just signed a contract for $118 billion, the NBA for $75 billion, and baseball for $12 billion. So you see where the money is going. Golf's not even in that picture. They have weekend-to-weekend events, but from an overall perspective of where money is being spent, golf is not even in the picture. Advertising money for postseason events in football, basketball, March Madness, dwarfs Major League Baseball. Golf's not even on the picture. So it's very popular around the Masters and some of the majors, but it's not a national sport that competes at the level of the NBA or the NFL at all.
So, Kevin, tell us about the movement that you have a very big role in, Save the Game. What is it all about? What's your goal?
The goal of Save the Game is exactly what we're saying. It's not a cliche or a sweet saying. We are trying to save the game from what we think baseball will be in 15 years, which would be irrelevant. And the reason for that is, once again, we believe the game has changed to the recipe of power swinging, which creates a lot of non-action in the game today. And it's driving away not just older fans who complain every day on the internet. You can see that. But the younger fans are not tuning in. They're not watching. They're not going to games. And those are the people, those are the generation of fans or customers, as you may want to call them, that's going to be needed to support the game in 15 years. You said that you were a sports junkie. I heard you, and so you must know Wayne Gretzky.
Yes.
Wayne Gretzky said something about hockey. He said that a good hockey player always knows where the puck is, but a great hockey player always knows where it's going. Same thing in business. You have to have a view forward. You have to see generational habits, generational trends. You need to see market trends. Where are things going? And the other sports have done that. They've connected with kids on digital devices. They've connected with them on Nickelodeon, the NFL. You know, baseball knows they have a problem. So they're trying to make changes to the game, as you know, to shorten the game. That's not the problem. The problem is the pace inside that game. A three-hour game that's boring, if you make it a two-hour and 40-minute boring game, it's not going to draw one more kid or one more person to the game because it's just a little bit less boring. Now, the NFL had playoff games recently that were fantastic, right? Everybody talked about them for days. They're all 3.5 hours long, 4 hours long. They drew 40 million people each game. Nobody complained that it was 3.5 hours because there was action inside the game throughout the game. And baseball has the 30-second home run event that they rely on now, and it's only 2.5 home runs hit per game. So you got to wait a long time for action to occur in baseball. Mm-hmm. So we feel that in 15 years, with vision, we're looking where their business is going, and we want to get this national movement is designed to get 1 million signatures across America to bring to Major League Baseball. We have support from a lot of the ex-Major League players that are going to go and sit with Major League Baseball when we get this audience and begin to discuss with them how we can help the change what they're doing so we can drive new customers to their business. And that's the goal of it. And the goal is to get the average, ordinary fan across America who's complaining every day and harness that discontent into a positive voice so we can give a voice to the fan to Major League Baseball.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, too, Kevin, before I let you go, what do you think about the lack of rivalries? You know, my husband's a Sox fan. I'm a Yankees fan. So we started off our relationship about, well, over a decade ago, and it was pretty rocky during baseball season. But now it's just not really a thing anymore. We both grew up in the 90s, so there was this deep hatred for the Sox or vice versa for the Yankees. And it just doesn't really exist in baseball, it feels like. Do you think that has any significance?
Well, two things. Number one, I failed to give you the website for the million signatures. www.savethegameus.com is where we need people to go to sign a petition to get this million signatures so we have collateral and power for the fan to Major League Baseball. So savethegameus.com. As far as rivalries go, the rivalry between New York and Boston is always there. Maybe it's a little less, as you say. Part of the reason is that we play across the leagues now, right? The NL plays the AL. It used to be that the Red Sox played the Yankees, I don't know, 30 times a year. It was a big, big rivalry. So that has diminished somewhat, but it is still there. But baseball in general, it's losing its popularity. It's losing its edge, so to speak. So. Mm.
Yeah, and that website, again, is Save the Game. It's all spelled out, SaveTheGameUS.com. SaveTheGameUS.com. If you love baseball as much as I feel like baseball, it's so sad to even think like that potentially in the next 15 years, it could be too stale to even keep around. I mean, that reality just seems crazy, but you know, there's a lot of data and facts showing that could be the way that we're trending. So, Kevin Gallagher, I really appreciate you bringing this to our attention. And again, go to Save the Game. US.com if you're passionate about keeping the game of baseball fresh and on top of mind for a lot of sports fans out there. We really appreciate the work you're doing, Kevin. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much. Need the help of the fans. Sign the petition. Thank you.
All right, and you can find that petition again at SaveTheGameUS.com. I am so excited to have my dear friend back on the show this morning. Rabbi Shalom Landa is here from Chabad of Fairfield. And good morning to you, Rabbi. So glad to have you here ahead of Passover. How are you?
Thank God. We're doing great. And we're excited to be back with you, Melissa.
I know. I love having you on the show. And I was so excited because, of course, out of all the rabbis in Connecticut, everyone's been talking about you, Rabbi Landa. I have to say, you have been the talk of the town the last couple, I'd say 24 hours for sure, distributing 1,200 packages of matzah. And are you going to be doing that today? Is that happening today?
So we started last week and we are continuing throughout this week. Up until Friday evening when Passover begins.
Okay, so why did you decide to do this?
So this was actually the inspiration of our community as a whole. Back in 1954, Rabbi Menachem Schneerson of Righteous Memory, widely considered the most influential rabbi in modern history, launched a Passover campaign to create awareness and to promote observance of the holiday. And one of the things that he encouraged was the importance of not only the square machine-made matzah, which we can typically find in local stores, but also of having our seders feature a round, handmade shmura matzah, which is the same way that these matzahs were when our ancestors left Egypt, over 3,300 years ago, as famously described in the Torah, in the Bible. They did not have a chance. They left in great haste. They didn't have a chance for their bread to rise, their dough to rise, or turn into regular bread. And so they had these unleavened cakes, and that's what we eat. So back then, they didn't have machines. It was hand-baked, and that's how we do it today. So this is something that the Rebbe, Rabbi Schneerson, encouraged. Our community here in Fairfield has been inspired tremendously by the Rebbe and his love for fellow. Today is actually the 120th anniversary of the Rebbe's birth. What would have been his 120th birthday. So we wanted to do something really big and really exciting, to show our love and care that has been inspired by the Rebbe in honor of his 120th birthday.
I knew April 12th was important. I was like, there's something going on today, though, Rabbi. I knew there was something. That's very neat. Wow.
Yeah. So that's how this all came about. And you know, we figured we'll give every single person we know a hand bake, the Rolls Royce of matzahs, if you will.
That's amazing. Now, where'd you get all the matzah, Rabbi? Yeah.
It wasn't easy.
How did you even advertise for that? Like, I need matzah, guys. I need a whole lot of it. I need it. Where'd you get it all?
So we went to a few distributors of matzah, rented a big old U-Haul and drove down to Brooklyn and filled it up. And you know, we've been distributing it since.
Wow.
So it took a little bit of some connections. Had to pull some strings.
That's amazing, though. You know what? Everyone knows someone who knows someone, and that's amazing. And what you're doing is so beautiful. I already got a couple of phone calls just during my show yesterday. It was in my newscast that you guys were doing this, and I had people asking for the number, asking for the website. So you know people are excited for this. And we're talking this morning to Rabbi Landa of the Chabad of Fairfield, and this has been all over the news, distributing over 1,200 packages of matzah. So for people who are not familiar, Rabbi, I realize that you and I are talking about this because we're very familiar with it. But what is matzah? If people have never even heard of it, seen it, tasted it, for the record, it's so good. I mean, I love putting some peanut butter, even just butter on it. It's so good. But what is matzah for anyone who's never eaten it before?
Okay. So one of the Passover observances is that we don't eat any leavened grain. So there's no bread, there's no cakes, there's no cookies. Again, this goes back to that idea that when the Israelites left Egypt, they left in a great rush, and they didn't have any leaven. They didn't have time for their bread to rise as it typically would. And so we observe that by not eating any leavened grains. So again, it could be bread, cake, cookies, cereal, pasta, most alcoholic beverages as well, other than wine. And so throughout the 8 days of Passover, we don't eat any leavened bread. Instead, what we do is we eat something called matzah, which is a flat, unleavened bread. If it's made by machine, it's usually square. You can find it in a box, in most local groceries, or as a handmade, it's a round, flat bread. And it's actually a biblical commandment to partake in the matzah for the first two Seder nights, which would be this coming Friday night, as well as a Saturday night. And then during the rest of the holiday, we don't eat leavened bread, but it's optional. So if you enjoy the matzah and you have some butter or peanut butter that you like to spread in it, that would be great. You can be eating for the full 8 days.
It's really good. I don't know any other way to put it. I think it's very, very tasty. And it's funny, my son, I will never forget, because, you know, again, it's kind of a bland cracker, essentially. If you've never eaten it before, it is kind of bland. I mean, I grew up eating it, so I think it tastes delicious. But a lot of people kind of get that bland taste to it. My son, I will never forget being at his first Passover. He wasn't even a year yet, and he was housing matzah as an infant, and I thought, wow, okay. I mean, I was very impressed, just because typically it just doesn't have a lot of taste to it, but plain matzah, he was totally into it. So it's I don't know. I think if you want a little more taste, though, I do recommend a little PB&J on it, or maybe if you want to just put butter, it's really good. You could put, I don't know, Harosset on it. Oh my goodness, that's the best.
Now we're talking
deliciousness.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. It's
so
good.
It really is like you're saying. It's not. It's a very simple food. There's not a lot to it. Some might refer to it as bland, right? But it's what it symbolizes spiritually.
Exactly.
Which is really the significance. And matzah is actually called, it's referred to as the bread of faith and the bread of healing in Jewish mystical tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
So that was also part of the inspiration that, you know, we felt as a community that the world, especially given recent history, healing and faith is something that's an important message to share and to welcome, and share the joy of the holiday with others.
Amen to that, Rabbi. Rabbi Shlom Landa is here this morning from Chabad of Fairfield. And I wanted to talk now about Passover, the Passover holiday for people who don't celebrate it. Let's start with that. What is Passover?
Okay, so Passover is an eight-day holiday. This year, it begins on Friday, April 15th at sundown, and it concludes after nightfall on Saturday, April 23rd. The holiday commemorates the freedom of the Jewish people from enslavement in ancient Egypt, going back some 3,335 years ago to the year 1313 BCE. So the Jews were enslaved for many decades in Egypt. And then as the Bible describes, God sent Moses to Pharaoh with the famous message to let my people go. Initially, Moses' warnings were dismissed, and God sent upon Egypt 10 plagues, the last one being the killing of the Egyptian firstborn while passing over the Israelite homes, which is where the holiday gets its name, Passover, because the Jewish homes were passed over. And we observe it, as I mentioned earlier, by not eating any leavened grain and by eating the matzah instead. One of the, perhaps the highlight of Passover is a feast called the Seder, where we eat the matzah. There's three matzahs that are a part of the Seder table, as well as four cups of wine or grape juice, and all the other types of delicacies. You mentioned the charoset earlier, which is symbolizes the mortar of the bricks that the Jews were making while they were in slavery. And that Seder is observed each of the first two nights of the holiday. It's a 15-step, multi-sensory, family-oriented feast, which is, you know, jam-packed with customs and traditions, and is aimed at engaging especially the children, and encouraging the children to ask questions and to discuss the story of the Exodus and the messages that Passover has. So Passover is it's the festival of liberation, but it's not just to remind us of the liberation of our ancestors from Egyptian bondage. It's also meant to inspire each one of us that we should strive for a greater measure of self-liberation, you know, from any limitations, any distractions which impede us from freely exercising, our deepest truths in everyday life. Mm-hmm. And that's actually there's a famous passage. There's a book called the Haggadah, which is read and which tells over this story. And there's a famous passage that is recited each year at the Passover Seder, which says, in every generation, one should see themselves as if they personally have been liberated from Egypt. It's not simply a celebration of the historic liberation of an ancient people, but it's also about our personal liberation, our physically, emotionally, and spiritually, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so true. And actually, speaking of generations being at the table, really quick, talk about the afikomen. That's a very popular thing that we do at our table every year.
There we go. So the afikomen, there is a back in biblical times, Jews would come from all over Israel, and they would go to the temple in Jerusalem, and that's where they would observe the Paschal service. Each year, we have at the matzah, there are three matzahs. Part of the Seder ceremony is we break the middle matzah into two parts, and we put one away for dessert. Actually, the last thing we eat at the Passover Seder is a little bit of matzah. We end off with that taste in our mouth, that taste of liberation, if you will, and that symbolizes the actual Paschal service that was performed. And one of the things that is engages the children is that the children can either hide the afikomen, and the adults can they'll take that matzah, wrap it up in a bag, and hide it somewhere around the house, and the adults have to go and search for it. In other communities, sometimes the adults will hide it, and or the adults will keep it on their person, and the kids will come try to steal it and hide it somewhere, and then the adults will redeem it for a prize at some point later on in the during the Seder. And the idea is, again, to engage the children, make it exciting, make it memorable. One thing the Rebbe actually spoke about with the afikomen is that it would be better for the adults to hide it and for the children to find it, rather than
that's what we did. I've never heard of the kids hiding it. I didn't know that you could do that. Yeah. We were always told I can't do it anymore. But back when I was a kid, they oh my gosh, my grandfather loved hiding it. Now my dad, being the grandpa in the family, he hides it. But it's I was always told it was the adults hiding it. But we could have hid it this whole time. It could have been us in control.
So
I had no idea.
There are some there are some communities where the children sort of sneak it and take it away from the parents or the adults when the adults aren't looking, whoever's leading that Seder.
Mm-hmm.
But the Rebbe spoke about, you know, even the importance of education. You know, even something as small as that, you shouldn't teach a child to steal in that sense. Even if it's only
right.
as a joke,
there you
it's
go.
It's only as a game. Let the adults do it. Teach the children to do good things. So it's another way of really engaging and getting the children involved in the process. And some families can act out the story of Passover. It's a lot of song, a lot of engagement. And it's really a fun, memorable time for all. But I want to hear your grandparents' matzo ball recipe.
Our matzo ball recipe. I actually think this Friday that I think my mom's going to do that for her cooking with Claude because she has my grandmother's recipe. That's what she makes that. So she's now like she always was helping with the official cooking for Passover, but I think that's what she's making. I think she's going to tell us her matzo ball recipe. Yeah. Oh, sure. So you got to tune in Friday morning. You got to hear it. Claude's got that recipe. Yeah, absolutely.
It'll be on my calendar. Absolutely.
You're the best. Well, Rabbi Londa, happy Passover to you. Thank you so much for coming on this
morning. My pleasure. Happy Passover to you and to all your listeners.
Thank you. We so appreciate it. Rabbi Londa here on WICC. Something very exciting is happening today right here in Bridgeport. St. Vincent's Medical Center will be the first in the state of Connecticut to use the latest robotic technology for neurosurgery. It is a 3D scope system, basically mapping out the brain, giving a shorter surgery, better outcomes, and quicker recovery. So you knew I had to jump on this story. Joining me now is Dr. Pedro Coutinho, and Dr. Coutinho is a neurosurgeon who specializes in spine and has the 3D exoscope for spine and brain and can tell us all about it. So thank you so much for being here, Dr. Coutinho. We really appreciate it. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me. I'm great. How are you?
I'm very good. I would imagine you're very excited about this. Tell me, I don't know much about the 3D scope system. What is that?
There is a phenomenal tool that we just acquired at St. Vincent's Medical Center. Actually, it's going to be the first one in the whole New England area. And it is pretty much like a microscope, but we don't have the ocular. So we look at a 55-inch screen, and we can perform surgeries using 3D visualization and magnification. So it's phenomenal.
So this is the first one you're saying in New England. Why was St. V's chosen? Do you know?
They want us to start also to be a hub for training future surgeons who want to incorporate the technology. And we were chosen to start the service in New England area.
That's incredibly honoring. That's exciting.
Sure.
I mean, how long have you been a neurosurgeon?
I've been a neurosurgeon for 14 years, and I specialize in complex spine and minimally invasive spine surgery. So specifically for my field of practice, this is a great acquisition. We operate on very confined environment through tubes, and magnification with 3D capabilities is something that we're always looking for. We also integrate intraoperative imaging, including intraoperative CT scan and X-rays. So it is important to have something that gives you good visualization, but does not occupy a lot of space in the room. And that's why this exoscope, 3D exoscope, is a perfect solution for our practice.
So we're talking this morning to Dr. Coutinho, who is a neurosurgeon with St. Vincent's Medical Center. I'm curious, Doc, in your field of practice and how long you've been doing this, tell us, you know, what this medical advancement really means. Like, what were people previously having to do when they'd go in for surgery? As I mentioned in the opening, this is apparently a shorter surgery, better outcomes, quicker recovery. So what did it look like before, and why are we now seeing much better results with this option?
That is correct. So the spine practice has changed a lot over the last 10, 15 years with the incorporation of what is called a minimally invasive surgical techniques. So minimally invasive means that you want to achieve the same goals as traditional surgery, however, without causing too much harm to normal tissue. So, for example, I operate on spine every day. In order to get to the spine in the past, you would have to cut the patient open and split muscles apart and cause a lot of damage to normal and natural tissue before getting to the spine. With minimally invasive techniques, you go, instead of making long incisions, you make like very tiny incisions, and with the help of endoscopes and tubes, you can get to the spine and achieve the same goal as traditional surgery in the long term. However, without hurting muscles, without hurting ligaments, tendons, stuff that is not supposed to be hurt during the surgery.
What does your ideal patient look like? Who are the people who are going to be coming in for this surgery?
We operate on every kind of spine pathology. So just because it's more prevalent, the degenerative disease are pretty much what we see on a daily basis, right? So patients with disc herniations or some spine instability or something that is called canal stenosis when arthritis leads to compression of the nerves or the spinal cord. But we also can apply that same new technology in the operation of patients with infections, tumors in the spine, and also trauma. So this is pretty much like we can use it for every single thing, every a single kind of surgery we do. And I have no doubts that patients are going to benefit a lot from this technology.
And I'm curious, Dr. Coutinho, if somebody is wants to have this done or wants to even meet with a doctor to talk about if this is a possibility for them, is that something that St. V's can do?
Yeah, definitely. We have we are a team of five neurosurgeons that operate on spine and brain. So we also have a very comprehensive team that is non-operative, including pain management, physical therapy, and all the ancillary staff. So we have office in Westport, Connecticut, in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and in Milford, Connecticut. So I'm quite sure that, and also we have PA. So we always have people who are willing to see patients who come with like primary care physician referrals or even self-referrals to learn if they are surgical eligible. And if they are, then we can educate them about all the options and what we can do.
Are you going to be performing one of these today?
That is correct. Yeah. So
are you nervous?
I'm not. I mean, so I'm super excited. This is just like an improvement of what we already have. Mm-hmm. We have like a phenomenal microscope that have been serving us in an excellent way. But right now, what happens is that instead of having the ocular, so we don't have to look through the ocular. So there are two big screens in the room, and we use goggles that turns the image 3D. So not only the surgeons, but also the anesthesia team, the scrub techs, people who are in the room, they can see exactly what we're doing. So this is perfect also for teaching. And this is something, this kind of plan that it's like in the midterm. We want to incorporate at St. V's.
That is so cool. Well, good luck today, Dr. Coutinho, and I appreciate you coming on this morning to share the great news with us here on WICC.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Have a great one.
You too. We are welcoming Fran Mako back to this side of the country. She was over in Hawaii visiting family, and she is back now with AAA. Good morning, Fran. Welcome back. Did you get some sun?
Morning. Good morning.
Did you get to do, like, any hula dancing or anything? Well, your daughter lives out there, right?
Yeah, she lives in the shadow of Diamond Head. Mm. The weather was great. I don't know why I live in the Northeast. The weather is just so great.
Oh, man. Then you need, like, a vacation from your vacation, right? You think, oh, man.
Actually, it's funny you should say that. I did say that because coming home was the trip from hell. I left Honolulu on a Thursday at 1. I didn't walk into my house until Saturday at 3 a.m. I missed connections. Flights were canceled.
I had to
go from one end of California to the other to take a flight.
Good Lord.
It was difficult. It was difficult because of the weather.
Oh, boy.
In the Midwest.
Hey, well, I certainly look forward to the ride home when we leave in June. We're going to Hawaii for the first time in June. I'm very excited about it.
Oh, check out Diamond Head. Where are you on the Big Island?
Yes.
Okay, the zoo, Honolulu Zoo. She can see the giraffes from her little apartment.
That's so cool.
It's really nice. Yeah,
that is so neat.
It's really nice.
Wow, that is amazing. Oh, I love that. That is so cool. Well, welcome back. I'm so glad that you are here, Fran. And in the midst of a very important week, this week is National Work Zone Safety Awareness Week. And I know you're going to be doing a news conference later this morning, but tell us the importance of this week and why it's held in April.
Okay, it is National Work Zone Safety Awareness Week. And basically, this is the week that it's for all you folks whose office is on Connecticut roadways as opposed to a nice, cushy, you know, office behind a desk. And the DOT is actually leading the charge on this week. They're the ones that are sponsoring the news conference. And basically, it's to remind the driving public to use extra caution when driving through work zones, whether they're on highways or back roads. And various parties, DOT officials, state police, we from AAA, we're going to be participating to make sure people understand that work zones are signs to slow down.
Yeah.
And as AAA, we're using it to take the opportunity to promote the state's slow down move over law, which says if you see an emergency responder or a fire truck, a police officer, DOT, EMTs, tow truck drivers assisting motorists on the roadside, you need to slow down to a reasonable speed. And if possible, and this is a key word, if possible, move over to give these folks space.
Fran, didn't you have a colleague of yours who was in a near-death experience because of isn't that what prompted this law?
Well, the law went into effect in 2009 in Connecticut.
Okay.
All 50 states have it, but we've always monitored it. And about 3 years ago, I hope Jay's listening, he was one of two employees that was involved in a very, very bad slowdown move-over crash in Fairfield. The most recent one was a big one on the Mara Parkway in Trumbull. Just before the pandemic, folks in Fairfield know Family Transport, Corey Iodice, well-known family, well-known name. He was in a crash that killed him when he was helping somebody, a disabled motorist.
Yeah, that was awful.
And you know, as an aside, I just want to throw this out. His sister, who lives in Honolulu, and I connected with her. She's a filmmaker. She's doing films on Slow Down, Move Over. She's doing PSAs, and she wants to take her campaign nationally. So people should check out this website called flagmansafety.com.
It's a really great website. What is the website again?
Flagmansafety, all one word,
.com.
She's created a little flagman, a little icon. But come heck or high water, she is going to take this campaign nationally. So people should check that out. But I kind of digress on this. But it is connected to work zone safety, too. It's really a good website.
No, it certainly is. We're chatting this morning with Fran Mako of AAA, and we're talking about a National Work Zone Safety Awareness Week, which is this week. And you're probably seeing a lot of the construction zones popping up. I know this week, for example, it's actually in our news this morning that the South Beach Avenue Bridge in Greenwich, they finally kicked off that construction work yesterday, and that's going to be in effect till July. And I know I'm seeing it around Milford as well. I think, Fran, the thing that is so concerning is people I know get frustrated because it does cause backups, it does cause delays, it causes traffic. Can you speak to, you know, some of the reasons why we see, unfortunately, these horrific incidents happen? It's mostly, I would say, because of distracted driving, right? Or just very speeding, frustration. What do you think?
It's a couple of factors. It is, in fact, distracted driving. you know, whether it's fiddling on your radio or talking on a cell phone, whether it's handheld or Bluetooth, you know, distraction is based on the conversation, not the physical part of driving. Your mind is on the conversation, not on the task at hand. But one of the other things is drunk driving.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was an issue in the Corey Iodice crash. The driver was drunk. And it's also speeding. People do not want to slow down. You know, during the pandemic, crashes spiked because there was no one on the road. And the folks that were on the road felt, oh, I can go faster because there's no one on the road. Well, bad habits are hard to break.
Mm.
And now people, a lot more people are on the road, but that habit has not been modified or changed. So basically, it's speeding, drunk driving, distracted driving, some cases drowsy driving. You know, people like truck drivers who, I think it's called hours of service, hours of service law. They're supposed to drive so many hours, then sleep so many hours. Sometimes that doesn't happen. So, I mean, all these things come into play, especially during a work zone.
Yeah.
You have people, you know, flagmen, as we call them, or people with the little, you know, cones. You have police directing traffic. And many times, I used to work at UI, and we had our utility workers working in such zones. And the folks would tell me, you don't know how many times I got sideswiped by a passenger side mirror.
Oh, that's awful.
People are just not aware. They misjudge things. And it's a matter of just simply slowing down and paying attention to details on the roadway.
Exactly. And just caring, just knowing, you know, these folks would like to get home as well. I know it's frustrating, and I've sat in traffic many a time being frustrated at the tree cuttings or whatever's going on. But at the end of the day, it's not worth taking a life, certainly, and that's terrible. Well, Fran, we so appreciate you talking to us about National Work Zone Safety Awareness Week. Thank you for coming on this morning. And again, welcome back. Glad to have you.
Thank you. Thank you. And people are urged to wear orange. That's the color representing work zone safety this week. So people should wear something orange to commemorate this week.
No problem. That's my favorite color. I know most people don't really love to have orange in their color palette for clothing, but that is no problem for me. So I will be doing that the rest of the week. Thank you, Fran. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Fran Mako of AAA here on WICC.